Welcome to Taste and See, a podcast of the Spiritual Formation Society of Arizona. My name is Gray Ewing, co-host and producer of the show. I'm joining up with Ted Wiestey, the other host of the show and the director of the Spiritual Formation Society of Arizona. Season 1, The Spiritual Practices of Jesus. Hello friends, welcome to another episode of Taste and See. This is a podcast where we have conversations about the spiritual practices of Jesus. It's during this season 1, so if this is your first time today, thank you for joining us. We called the podcast Taste and See, if you'll recall, because we're basing it out of Psalm 34, which says that taste and see that the Lord is good. And on the surface, we are seeing each other and also tasting good food. So part of our conversation always is to have a meal and also following in the way of Jesus in that way, because Jesus often, if you look at the Gospel of Luke, went and had meals with people. Some people say he ate his way through the Gospel of Luke. So he was tasting things and seeing people, as we're going to see in particular today. And so that was kind of the idea behind the podcast. And so my name is Gray Ewing. I am the pastor of New Valley Church in downtown Phoenix.
And I'm Ted Wiestey, the director of the Spiritual Formation Society. And this has been a lot of fun to do this podcast with Gray. And so in the spirit of Taste and See, we're trying to eat something or be at a restaurant that ties into the theme. Today we're talking about the spiritual practice of seeing and that Jesus saw people. We see that frequently throughout the Gospels, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. But as we thought about a place that might represent that, we tried to think about a place that had a great view of the city. And what we realized is that most of those places are only open at night, or they're incredibly expensive. And so I talked to my good friend Doug Kelly about coming and sitting on his patio, because he has one of the most amazing views of the valley just from his porch. It's not a porch. What do you call this? It's kind of a deck.
It's a pool patio.
Sure. But it wraps around the house, and we're looking out the front. Yeah. This beautiful view. So we're here with Doug Kelly, a good friend. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Doug.
Well, it's great to be here and have you guys here. And I'm a professor at Arizona State University, and been there 25 plus years at this point, studying relationships. And so this is a great topic. Anxious to hear what you all have to say and to take a look at how Jesus views people as well. So great to be here.
Yeah, well, yep. Thanks. And the view is pretty amazing. You might hear some birds chirping because we are outside and it's just a beautiful spring day.
Normally there's a pulsing beat going behind us, just like a, you know, or a Latin fusion or something. But today we have the birds with us. But I saw a statue of Saint Francis over there, so it's reminding me that we have a saint out here too, of the birds. And so thanks for having us here, and this is an incredible view. It's demonstrating how little I know about the geography of Phoenix in some ways, because I'm trying to identify mountains out here and stuff, but you probably could do that better than I could.
Well, I don't know how well I can do it, but I know that, like, when we found this place, we didn't even know this neighborhood existed, you know, pretty great.
Ted, maybe I could just turn it over to you and you could kind of set up where we're going with Jesus seeing people. Maybe set up that as a spiritual practice for us and where you kind of see that in the scriptures.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the themes that you see throughout the Gospels, and it can be easy to miss it, is that the Gospels would often say that Jesus saw someone and he responded, or he knew what was going on with them, knew what was in their heart. And one of the places that you see that very clearly is in Luke 7, where there's the woman who pours up perfume on Jesus' feet. And, of course, the disciples get irritated with that. You know, they think, what is going on here? You're wasting all this money. And Jesus responds to them by saying, do you see this woman? And it was an invitation for them to see what was going on, to see her and not just push her aside as a woman who was doing something they thought, you know, wasn't appropriate or right.
Rather than
or whatever.
Seeing a situation or a theological thing or something like that, he's saying, do you see this woman? Do you see this person?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you see what's going on? And I think in that there's an invitation for us as well to see the way that Jesus saw. And then, you know, another example in Mark chapter 10, of course, there's a very familiar passage of the rich young ruler. And the text says, looking at him, he loved him. And he said, you lack one thing, go and sell your possessions. And it's fascinating that it says he looked at him and loved him, as though looking at him and seeing him was a precursor to loving him and then even challenging him to go sell his possessions. And then, you know, in the following dialogue with his disciples, the text also says that he looked at them, but he didn't apply the same thing to them. He didn't say, go sell all your possessions. That was something that was unique to this, you know, rich young ruler, as he's called. He shared the principle, but then talked about leaving father and mother or really anything and invited them into that. And so it's just interesting that Jesus saw people and invited them and challenged them and loved them based on what he saw and who they were.
That's such an undercurrent of the gospel that I don't know that I've ever heard a podcast or a sermon on Jesus looking at people. But then when you see it, you kind of can't unsee it, so to speak. Pun intended, I guess, in some ways, because it really is everywhere. It's you see him looking at people, and there's different words sometimes that are used other than just looking at. But, you know, I'm thinking also of the passage where Lazarus is sick, and he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead. This is his good friend, Lazarus. And he's looking at Mary and Martha, who are the sisters of Lazarus, and he sees them, and he weeps at the graveside, and he's moved because he sees the situation, knowing even what he's going to do. He's going to raise this man from the dead, but it doesn't keep him from seeing that situation as a unique thing in and of itself, and almost acknowledging that moment, seeing their weeping before he does the thing that will end their weeping.
Yeah, just the idea that he wept with them. Is just amazing because he knew. He knew that he was going to raise Lazarus. He could have said, hey, it's okay, don't worry about it, everything's going to be okay. But he entered into their world and met them where they were.
And for me, in some ways, when he saw them, you know, he knows that he caused some of that pain. I mean, he right. delayed coming. They've come to him and pouring their hearts out. If you had been here, you wouldn't have died. You know, I mean, it's just the passion, that situation doesn't make it just okay, you know, and his response to seeing that and seeing their pain and their grief, and he weeps deeply, you know, as part of that as well. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and, you know, his seeing was not simply just a physical thing, although it was about that. He could see what was going on with people. There was really a much deeper seeing people's hearts. And John 16, talking about leaving the earth and sharing some things with the disciples, the text says he knew what they wanted to ask him. He could perceive and was aware of what was going on in their hearts. And I think about John chapter 2, the wedding where he turns water into wine. The text says he was not going to entrust himself to them because he knew what was in their hearts. And so you see similar things throughout the Gospels, phrases like he knew their thoughts or he knew what they were thinking. He perceived in the spirit. He was aware. All those kind of synonyms or other ways of saying that he saw. He understood.
It's not as though, so it's interesting what's happening when he looks and he sees. Is this like an example of Jesus' divine authority or divine power to be able to kind of psychically see all that's going on? It seems more tied to his humanity, the way that the scriptures present it. So it seems that he is discerning in the moment what this person needs. So there's almost a question of, like, if the theologians were here, they would say, is this an attribute of God that is communicated to us or not communicated to us? You know, because we don't see everything that God sees. But I do think that what Jesus is modeling here is something that we can do, meaning it's something that we can see in people, and even as we walk in the Spirit, discern and pray about and see people, and in the same way that Jesus does, reach into their situation and love them or challenge them or weep with them, all the things that he does. I think this is something that he intends us to replicate. What do you think of that?
Yeah, and I think it seems very clear that Jesus was having real relationships with people. You know, it wasn't though people were just sort of pawns on a chessboard and he was sort of manipulating things because he was clairvoyant or a psychic. And he in his humanity, he was relating to people where they were. And so you see that he wept or he loved or whatever, his response to really being aware of what was going on with people.
That's, for me, as a communication professor, I love that perspective, because even if Jesus did know some things that had a little edge on us in some ways, it, as cool as that is, like, it doesn't help us in any way, right? It doesn't help me be a better husband or father or friend or anything. But when I think about him really being in tune and in relationship with people, and that is a way of being and practicing my spirituality, then that's powerful for me, because, like, that's something that I can I don't want to just say do, like, put it on my list that I need to be better at it, but it's something that as I, you know, seek God more fully, like, I should see you more clearly, right? That should be part of it, you know, in First John, where he tells us, like, hey, if you don't love your brother, then you're not loving God, you know, and he sees such a strong link at that level. So that's a part that just kind of gets me excited.
It's so cool when our academic disciplines kind of line up with what Scripture says, the reality. You know, we believe that God's Word is reality. But this idea of seeing people is such clearly a part of the way that he's built us. We see examples of it in Scripture, but we also see it as just the way that we communicate. We have to look towards people to see them. And the way that we're visually even wired, created to be, we see things that are our goals in front of us. And we point ourselves to those things. So we kind of almost have a mistaken view sometimes, I think, that what we do and we see, as even as we're looking out on this vista, is that I'm seeing all of Phoenix or something like that. But really, my eyes are darting from individual thing to individual thing, goal after goal, you know. And when I'm driving, I'm looking at this line and this side of the road and then this sign. It's not that we're actually taking in the full world. We're actually directing our attention towards certain things all the time. And I don't know if you guys have heard of that famous invisible gorilla study. It's kind of a psychological experiment that they did back in the 90s, where this psychologist got a bunch of people to pass around a basketball. And there was two teams. One of them was a black team, and one of them was a white team, meaning they were wearing white or black jerseys. And he told people that were watching this, they made a video of it, he said, count the number of times that the white team passes the ball. This is your goal. Count the number of times that the white team passes the ball. So people start looking at this video and seeing people pass the ball, and they count, and they're watching, and they're watching, and they're watching. And then at the end, he says, so how many times did they pass the ball? Almost everybody said 15 times, and that it was, in fact, the correct answer. And then he said, but did you see the gorilla? Apparently, during this time, a man in a gorilla suit had walked out. And this is a very small frame video. It's like 10 people in this shot. This guy in a gorilla suit walks out, stands in the middle of the shot, beats his chest, and then walks off on the other side. And people do not see it. The majority of people, because now if you go watch the video and it's on YouTube, looking for that, then you'll see it. But if you're just told, you've never seen it before, and you're just told, watch the white team, the majority of people will not see the gorilla. Because, and the point is, their vision is focused, right? They're focused on one task at a time. And so it's so interesting that when Jesus comes, he, you know, just even the way that we're created, we know that we just focus on one thing at a time. And what he does over and over again is he looks at people and he sees them. And like, that's my goal. That's where I'm going, towards that person.
You know, as you share that, gosh, so many things come to my mind. And one of them is, there's a book several years ago by Malcolm Gladwell, and he talked about how humans are able to thin slice things, and they can just like see one little thing and then jump to a conclusion. And a lot of that's very adaptive, and it's a helpful thing because so much of, you know, the time we need to make a snap decision about something. We're driving
danger.
Or whatever, yeah. Or danger. But that doesn't necessarily come into a helpful place when we're thinking about relationships. You know, we don't want to just thin slice someone. Mm. We want to be able to see the whole picture. And the other thing that makes me think of is that Mr. Rogers movie that came out. I think we referenced this in the first podcast. So
it's your favorite movie.
It goes on. It's my favorite movie of the last year. But we've got a helicopter flying over right now.
Nice.
I'm probably looking for hikers on the mountain over there.
We're okay.
It's all right.
Okay.
It looks like we're dead, but we're not. And so in that Mr. Rogers movie, there's a scene where Fred Rogers is talking to the reporter, and he says, "You know what the most important thing in my world is right now?" Or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he's talking to him, and he says, "You are." Mm-hmm. And it's this thing of just total focus and listening. And of course, you know, in that movie, not to give it away, he really gets to know this guy and hears him and listens and comes from a posture of not knowing but wanting to see, as opposed to often we, to your point, I think we end up seeing what we want to see, and we superimpose things often onto people as well.
Oftentimes that translates into like seeing what we expect to see. So you're talking about personal relationships, and you knew that you didn't have time to clean the kitchen before you left for work. And
how did you know
that? It's
that was my
yes,
story.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah. Likely not any of our wives, but maybe a wife coming home before us would walk in, and the first thing she's going to see is that the kitchen's a total mess. Mm. And then I'm coming home thinking, oh, she's not going to understand what my day was like. And I'm already in defensive posture. And so I come in, and as soon as I hear or see any small cue that confirms that she's upset with me, I kick into that response. It confirms what I expected to see. And so it becomes almost a no-win situation unless you're really able to sideline that and come in and listen with an open perspective. Anne's tone of voice to me might be because she had a bad day at work, not because she's upset about the kitchen. But I hear a little tenseness in her tone, and it confirms my preconceptions. Mm-hmm. So in one sense, when you come in, you're focused, you're listening, right? But only for certain things, and that becomes the key. So how do we get to that place where we can have and cultivate that sense of openness and be open to like a variety of interpretations and understanding of others?
I think part of what I hear you saying in that, Doug, is to really be aware of others. We need to be aware of ourselves and what we're bringing into our perception and our seeing. And if we can let go of our preconceived ideas and that kind of thing, because we're aware of what's going on in our heart and mind, then we can approach someone with more of an open stance where we can really hear and see what's going on with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think our own sense of self and our own hurts and our own insecurities all create a variety of relational filters that we use when we see one another. Yeah. And we probably all have friends that virtually anything you say to them, they can take defensively, you know.
What are you talking about?
Exactly. That's it.
Are you talking about me?
That's right. Nice hat. Like, what's wrong with my other hat? You know, right. Nice. Yeah, you know. So,
right.
There are no guarantees from a communication standpoint, but we're definitely filtering everything as it comes through. And the more aware, like the goal isn't to get rid of filters, they're going to be there, but to be aware of them so that I can slow down for a second and check out my perceptions. So I come home and I hear the tenseness in Anne's voice, and I'm like, hey, tell me what's going on. And then she might say, I had a terrible day at work. Or she might say, I'm just so tired that when I came home and saw the kitchen a mess, my heart just sunk. Okay. All right. I get that. And then now I have a variety of ways to respond to that instead of defensiveness and defending myself and why I couldn't get it done or something to that effect, or judging her for being too sensitive or whatever it might be.
Yeah, you know, it's really the role of listening and hearing and perceiving someone's story is so significant. I remember years ago a friend talking about how we relate to others that, you know, often we ask the question, what's wrong with you? As opposed to saying, what happened? And when we ask the question, what happened or what happened to you, it reminds us that someone is in the midst of a story, mm-hmm. as opposed to just being this black and white sort of, you know, simple character that, you know, is either to my liking or not to my liking or whatever. And it's sort of a dualistic approach versus seeing that each of us are living in the midst of a story.
It's to return back to, yeah, Christ as well, and the way that he practiced this. He was always asking questions of people, always leading in with this self-examination angle, or riddles even, or, you know, just not like, here's the truth, let me drop it on you. He certainly does speak the truth, and he does preach, but even in those cases, there's kind of an inquisitiveness to it, and I don't know what the estimates are, but there's a lot of questions in the New Testament.
Well, you know, I'd heard it before, and then I read again this last week that there's probably over 300 questions that Jesus asks in the Gospels. And then there was another statistic, if you will, that he was asked about 180 questions, and that probably he only directly answered about 10 of those questions. And so apparently Jesus was okay with there being some mystery, not just totally interacting on this tit-for-tat sort of level where questions are being, you know, thrown back and forth and you give this simple answer, but it seems that he really wanted to connect with people at the heart level and not just the informational level, which is where questions sometimes fall. And, you know, Jesus would often ask, what do you desire? What do you want? And he would ask these questions that were intended to draw people's hearts out and even give them a sense of self-awareness so that that could be a part of the relational dynamic.
Yeah. As you're saying that, it's reminding me, just to go back for a minute to that passage about the rich young ruler. You know, what's interesting is that he is asked a question there, and it's, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Which evangelist among us wouldn't love to be asked that question directly? Then we can tell them what the spiritual laws are, which, how to pray, or, you know, whatever would come to mind for us. It's so interesting that Jesus doesn't answer that question right away. He doesn't say, you know, this is the way to eternal life. He challenges him. And what I love about that passage is, especially as it relates to him seeing him, is that, you know, we kind of have this idea that the rich young ruler was this snotty rich kid that everybody hated. And, you know, when Jesus says, you know, you have to sell everything, and then he walks away sorrowful, that everybody just kind of rejoiced and was like, oh, yeah, down with the rich kid. You know, you get what you deserve. But that's not how the passage portrays him at all. They're wondering who then can be saved. Who, if this guy is not in, because in reality, he was a seeker. He was actually humble, even though he was rich, young, powerful. Those are the three things that check most people's boxes on what a good life is: youth, power, money. And yet he sought Jesus. And what I love about how Jesus addresses him is, he says, you know, when he says that he looks at him and loves him, he says, I have kept all of the commandments from my youth. And that's when Jesus says, he looks at him and loves him. And it's like he sees him in his striving. That's just such a beautiful image of seeing someone. It's like you're seeing their effort, you know, and it's like he didn't just write him off as this kid who probably was self-righteous, and he saw his striving, and that's when he loved him, you know, and now he teaches him a better way, too, You know, he doesn't leave him in his striving. But I guess maybe as someone who's a striver and loves to do things, and you know, to have that sense that Jesus looks at me or looks at those of us who work hard or whatever, and says, like, you know, I love you. You know, I see what you're doing here.
Clearly in the Gospels, Jesus met people where they were. And you can even look at the fact that he said different things to different people because he really wanted to connect with where they were and connect with their heart and their story and what was really going on, and not just put out a set of principles and say, live by this. You know, it is fascinating that we definitely see some teaching in the Gospels. And there are sermons, there are things that Jesus said, but he didn't give us a theology book and say, here, live according to these 10 principles, you know, or these 14 steps,
right,
or whatever. It's very relational. It's a relational way that he invites us into, relational with God and relational with others. And, you know, one of the things that people have often noted is that there are two halves of life. And, you know, even in our culture, we talk about there being a midlife crisis. There's usually something that happens for us that there's a place of crisis. There's something that shifts for us that's going to determine how we live the rest of our lives. And for some people, you know, midlife happens earlier. For some people, it's later. But the journey is to become this holy, wise person who is able to love and to see people. And, you know, Jesus met people on the journey, and you know, for some people, their journey is one where they've experienced oppression and hurt and disappointment, and the journey is really one of healing and finding one's voice. And to people on a journey like that, Jesus says, "Rise, take up your mat and walk," or "Your sins are forgiven. Go in peace." And that's kind of this journey of ascent, where the first half of life has been marked by descent and maybe oppression, or you don't have a voice, you kind of recede to the background. He says, no, let's go. Come on, let's ascend into all that I designed you to be. And then there's other people where maybe we've experienced a life of success and prominence and building, you know, rich, young, powerful, like you were just talking about, Gray. And our ego can tend to be what's most significant. And to people on that journey, Jesus says things like, go sell your possessions, or take up your cross, or die to self. And that's been what people have talked about as a journey of descent.
Come with me into the wilderness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, to portray Jesus as this monolithic figure that just had one thing that he said to people is really a misreading of the scriptures. And it's not a nuanced understanding of what he was about.
There's this great quote from John Ortberg, who's kind of a leadership guy, church guru guy. He's written some amazing things, but he says that disciples are handcrafted, not mass-produced. And I love that, because we do have this mentality of, like, how do I make disciples? And then I replicate, and how do I replicate that? And I feel that tension, too, just wanting to be, in our systematic approach to things, really excellent. And yet, what Jesus invites us into is a slower, less measurable, less convenient, less sellable, you know, model of seeing people. And I, like, even in my own story, like, I, a church planter, replanted a church 3 years ago. And then, you know, you have all these ambitions and goals when you're planting a church, and it does take a unique person to be able to do it, because in a sense, your site is in all different places. You know, you've got your folks that are already there in your core team, got those stakeholders, and then you're if you're renting a building, you're watching, like, hey, are people going in the parts of the building that you shouldn't go to? And, you know, and then you got somebody saying, I'm getting a divorce, you know, right after the service. And then you're like, hey, but there's a new person back there that I should have greeted before they came in. And so your eyes are always just moving around, like, trying to, and your goal shifts. But I think, and some of that's necessary and needed, but I think as I walk more into the journey of discipling people, it's more of like, how do I let some of those things go away from seeing all of the goals at once and say, this is the goal that's in front of me. It's this person, this disciple needs this thing right now. And I've got to be okay with some of those other things being, you know, in God's hands.
You know, as we talk about this spiritual practice of Jesus being the practice of seeing, maybe another way we could say it's to practice relationships. That's at the core of what it means to follow Jesus is we're practicing relationships. We're intentionally putting our focus and our gaze on people and meeting them right where they are. And so, that whole thing of disciples are handcrafted, not mass-produced, you know, we're called to be relational artisans, you know, where we are engaged with people and loving them where they are, not giving them a set of things and saying, you need to, you know, conform to this. But it's relational.
If I can make a shameless self-plug, I have a book on intimacy coming out this summer, and the second, just real short little chapters, talks about being made for intimacy. That's out of God's nature, right? Because he wants intimacy with us, but then he's created us for intimacy with one another as well. And you can look at everything from the long gestation period, the long time we're in the womb, there's all kinds of good stuff going on hormonally to bond us to mom, and then we just can't be on our own for a long time after we're born, right? So, right, everything developmentally is relational, really. You know, even, you know, teaching our kids, like, you know, say mama, 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 you know, the first words are relational words usually. And so we grow up in that world, and somewhere along the way, we learn not to be as relational for many of us. Right? And three men sitting around this microphone, you know, that, you know, in particular for us sometimes, that can be tough because in our culture, we're not valued for just having good friendships. We're really valued for what we've accomplished, like you were talking about earlier. And so I think that to really embrace that in a significant way is not easy.
Bringing out the aspect of God's character too, and that he's our Father and he nurtures us by seeing us. I was at a baseball game one time, which is a little kids baseball game, and the dads were screaming out, you know, they have this phrase that they were saying over and over again. I see you, Billy. You know, I see you. It's like, when they were doing the right thing. You know, it's like they got down right away into their stance, or they swung, but they kept their eyes on the ball, or you know, it was whatever they were working on. It's like I'm watching you do the right thing right now, and I thought that was beautiful. It's like I see you. That's a gift from a parent. You know, and it's a gift from our Father that he sees us. He says, I see what you're doing. We talk about the beatific vision, you know, our gaze at God, but what about his gaze towards us?
That's so powerful. I love this idea that I see you, like, which I suppose could have a negative side too, like, I see you,
right.
I know what's going on.
You don't want to go there too much, yeah.
And, I always remember I was playing with my cousin, Bobby, and when we were little and his mom called for him. And he responded, I'm not doing anything, you know, and she just, it was lunchtime, you know, it was like, but he immediately thought like, you know, she knows what I'm up to. But I think like, it's so powerful to recognize someone, and even in the adult world, and like, you think of those of us who've worked someplace where you're pretty much not seen, and you just come in each time, and whoever the boss is just blows by you, or other people do, like you're not there. And it's just disconfirming, I guess, at such a deep level to not be recognized, to not be noticed in some particular way. And to think that God sees you, and that one of the biggest gifts for us could just be to see someone. I think of another experience I had when I was in college. I went on an urban program with Westmont College, which is in Santa Barbara, but they had a program in San Francisco that I was part of. And one night we did this sort of urban plunge experience that a lot of people have done, but we slept on the streets that night, and I tried panhandling for some money because we only were allowed to take bus fare down to get down and get back. So if you were going to eat, you had to go to the soup kitchens, or you had to get money from someone. And when I would walk up to ask somebody for money, which is one of the most humiliating things I ever did, mostly they wouldn't look at me in the eye. Right? I was a non-person. And I think of how often with the homeless here and others that I don't see them, right? I don't want to see them. I don't want to be responsible in any way toward them. And that's a lot easier if I don't look at them. So that's such a powerful idea, to just recognize someone and their presence, that they're there, that I see you.
And it comes with a responsibility.
Yeah. Oh, it does. Yeah.
That reminds me, when I was in my early 20s, I had this job, and I had a boss that I certainly wanted to please. You know, I think for most of us, that's kind of our goal. And and he didn't really ever say much about what I was doing, if I was doing a good job or a bad job or whatever. I don't remember ever having like an annual review or anything. But I said to him one day, I went up to him and I said, hey, I just want to know how I'm doing. You know, am I doing a good job or whatever? And he said to me, in that moment, he said, no, you're doing a fine job. But if you're ever doing a bad job, I'll let you know. and I remember thinking, you know, I wanted him to see me. I wanted to know that he saw what was going on. And then it was like, well, no, I'll only really respond to you if you're doing a bad job.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, not only are we invited to see other people, we long for that. Mm. We long to be seen. And the other thing that makes me think of, and I think I have this right, you remember the movie Avatar?
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, isn't that what they said? Instead of I love you, they would say I see you.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. And I don't know if we want to make all these big theological statements from the movie Avatar necessarily.
Right.
But that was how the people, you know, on that planet or whatever expressed I love you, is to say I see you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I can take that on a little bit of a turn just in some of the research we've done. I've been studying forgiveness for 20 years. And one of the things that we know about forgiveness is that it requires empathy. So, I mean, you can do it out of duty, but it's not much of a forgiveness usually. It's either letting somebody off the hook or forgiving them and then ignoring them, or trying not to be around them because you're still bitter. And but to somehow empathize with that other person, it means seeing them, right? You have to be able to see them in some way. And if you can't see someone that way, it's very difficult to forgive in any real way. And Ted, you mentioned something earlier in the discussion about asking what happened. And that's a question I ask my students to consider regarding forgiveness. Like, no one's born with just a head full of intent to go out and hurt other people all the time. Right. Something happened along the way. And so that what happened question is a question that it's really trying to lead you to, so I can see you, right? And once I see you, it doesn't excuse bad behavior. I'm not suggesting that in any way, but it rehumanizes you, right? It makes you a person. I remember that you're God's creation. He's got you on some path, and I began to see you with new eyes.
I wonder if we could transition to maybe some of the challenges of seeing people, because this is not something that necessarily comes naturally to us. We tend to be pretty self-focused. So what comes to mind, guys, when you think, you know, what are the challenges of seeing people?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Jesus tells a story about having the log in your eye. And it's interesting because it's actual seeing that he's talking
visual
about.
Visual impairment.
But yet there's that metaphorical layer of seeing someone else. And so, you know, he says, before you try to take the speck out of someone else's eye, you need to take the log out of your own. And so I think a lack of self-awareness can be a huge obstacle, a huge challenge to really seeing people. And some people have even noted that, you know, when you have that in your eye, you superimpose it onto someone else. So it could be that you take that log out and you realize, oh, what's in their eye isn't that big a deal, or there's not even anything there perhaps. And so you know, we can't really see others when we haven't seen ourselves. We have to encounter our own hearts and lives well before we can see others. Otherwise, we're kind of blinded, or at least our ability to see is distorted.
Another challenge that comes to my mind is that it's the one that I mentioned earlier. We're trying to see too many things. We want all of everything at once. So it's like we're looking towards future goals, and what happens is when you're just thinking about goals, then people will become part of some other kind of ambition. And so they're means to an end. And if they're not, you know, meeting that end, or they're not meeting your emotional needs or your ministry purposes or whatever it might be, then you can kind of ignore seeing them. And so I think one of the things that we have to do is, one of the challenges that we have to address is, how do I keep looking beyond what God has put in front of me, you know, and rather say, like, what has he given me right now to see?
You know, having a humble, open posture seems to be just incredibly important. So the challenge or the obstacle would be thinking that we know. And so, again, having an awareness to be able to let go of some things so that we can then just be aware of what's going on. Anthony DeMello said this. He said, most people don't live aware lives. Mm. They live mechanical lives, mechanical thoughts, generally somebody else's, mechanical emotions, mechanical actions, mechanical reactions. And so without some sense of the ability to be introspective, to be aware of what's going on in us, we'll probably respond mechanically to things, or just not even really respond, but more react. And seems as though the idea of seeing is so that we can respond to people where they are.
I know for me, in those kinds of mechanical responses, the habitual learned responses, that a lot of them that become so problematic are coming out of our own pain, out of our own hurt. And so we've felt dismissed, or like somebody hasn't seen us before, and or worse, we felt betrayed or without a voice. And so that kind of deep place, I start this rote kind of response, you know, that comes very quickly. That's not just what I say or whatever, but it's how I see you, right? It's what's going on internally that happens. So to return to like some of the stuff we've done with forgiveness, like one of the hard things about forgiveness is just that somebody's done something wrong, like they've hurt you, and man, it's hard to get past that. It feels unjust. We live in a culture that highly values justice and doesn't value mercy as much. And I think oftentimes that imbalance between justice and mercy is brought into the church as well, where we're more concerned about God being a just God than we are that he's a loving God. So I know that for people that I talk to that really struggle with forgiveness, they get hung up in that spot, and they just can't get past the idea of what's happened to them.
You know, Doug, what that makes me think of is we probably need to have you back for another podcast to just walk through forgiveness
as a
total thing that we do, because it's incredibly significant. And, you know, then another challenge I think of is time. And maybe even time and money. And I don't necessarily mean money in terms of, you know, green cash or something in a bank account, but money being what we value, what our currency is. Mm. And oftentimes we, you know, time and money, that's everything, right? And so investing relationally and really seeing someone, it takes time. And it can keep us from doing other things. And it can even keep us away from earning more currency in whatever it is we value. Mm-hmm. And so it seems as though a shift in what we value is a significant part of this. You know, are we really valuing relationships as the currency of my life, where that is the value? That is what life is about. That's what brings my life meaning, is relationships. Mm-hmm. And like you said, sometimes you know, we engage with people to the degree that they help our bottom line, mm-hmm. whatever that is,
right.
you know, whatever our goals are. But if our goals shift to being about relationships mm-hmm. and love, then taking the time to see someone mm-hmm. and to hear their story, it's a worthwhile investment, to put it in those terms.
It strikes me as something that people will not be able to quickly flip a switch and do, but it's almost a structural thing too, because the way that our lives are currently lined up, it's often very hard to see people. So it's almost like creating, you know, what would it mean to create a morning where you see your spouse, you know, or an afternoon where you see your kids, you know, or enough space in your life that you see your friends and you see them and you know them. It's almost like the challenge comes not just in the moment, but like how can you structure your life so that you can see people? Maybe that would be a first of several questions that we could end with. I mean, that's a good challenging yeah. question. How can you structure your life in such a way that you can see people? I'm just diving in for a first question. We like to end our shows typically with some questions for reflection, give a little space to it. So I went first there, so somebody else dive in with another question.
Well, I think another question is just how well do we know ourselves? Mm-hmm. How much time do we spend not in navel-gazing just for the sake of it, but developing an awareness of what's going on in me so that I can more fully love others and even receive God's love in the real conditions of my life?
I think for me, like, I'm often asking, like, how can I better empathize with others, like, get in their shoes, kind of get into their story, or find out about it. I just personally, like, it's a lot easier and sometimes more fun to judge people, and I have to roll that back for a minute, and like, how do I get in to this other person's story? And not just go with my kind of knee-jerk judgment.
Another question we could ask is, do I cultivate a prayerful and attentive way of being with other people? So is prayer for me something that's just something I go into a closet somewhere and it's just myself and God? Or can I be with people in a moment in a prayerful way? And just experiencing life with them, being in their shoes, empathizing. Is that something that ever happens in my life?
And then maybe a final question we would ask ourselves is, do I allow people to have a story that I can see? Do I slow down enough? Do I stop so that I can see their story and perceive and be aware of what's going on with them? And I think about, you know, often there are tools that are developed that help us with this. You know, we talked about that journey of ascent and descent, and that can be a helpful thing to think about, just where someone's coming from. You know, over the years in church history, different authors have talked about different ways of even seeing the spiritual journey and where we are on the journey. People have come up with different temperament tools that can help us understand someone's temperament, for example. And the danger with those kind of things is that we can end up just pigeonholing someone. But if used well, those things can actually give us eyes to see. And so a couple of things. Earlier, Doug was plugging his book that comes out this summer on intimacy, which I look forward to seeing. But we have a couple of things coming up this spring and then summer. We have an Enneagram workshop, which is the Enneagram is a kind of an ancient tool that looks at temperament and looks at it from a very spiritually based perspective. And so we're doing a workshop on that in April. It's on April 4th, and I think it's going to be super helpful as a way of seeing yourself, but then also seeing others. And then this summer we're doing a spiritual formation discovery where we take the seven mansions of Teresa of Avila's interior castle that she wrote 500 years ago, where she talks about these different stages on the spiritual journey. And it can be incredibly helpful to know where you are in the journey so you can participate with God and let him love you right where you are. And then also just have that as a lens for thinking about where other people are. because often we just assume that the faith is kind of either this or that. You're either walking with God or you're not. But there are stages, there's development, there's progression. So those are a couple of tools. And actually, the discovery that we're doing this summer is in June. And you can learn more about that on our website at sfsaz.org.
I will definitely put my plug in for that as well. The discovery, well, both of them, but the discovery in particular has been extremely helpful. I took it the last time we hosted it. It was very, very helpful for that season. So if you're wondering, like, what is my spiritual journey? Where has God taken me before, and where might he be taking me next? Those are really valid questions. And what would it look like to take a day or two? Is it a two-day one or is it a one-day?
It's 3 days.
3 days, yeah. So the three-day version, that's even better. The space around it to make those valuations and to think about, you know, what has God been like for me at different parts of my story? It will help you understand yourself, and it will help you see other people as a result. So that website one more time is sfsaz.org. Sign up for those there. We're just extremely grateful that you've joined us today for another discussion. I'm Gray Ewing.
I'm Ken Wiesting.
Doug Kelly.
Thanks for being here today, Doug. Peace.